Hey, did you hear? I've got a new book out. It's called How to Live a Good Life: Soulful Stories, Surprising Science, and Practical Wisdom. I've been working on this baby for a number of years now. It's the distillation of about 50 years, 50 plus years now on the planet. The opportunity to sit down with hundreds of astonishing teachers and find patterns, you know, things that really, really move the needle, and also sharing a single idea, a single model, a lens on life that you'll hear once, you'll remember forever, and it may guide the way that you move into the world from this moment forward and hopefully make a really big difference. We have a really cool pre-order initiative going on where we're working with a foundation to plant trees as well. So when you pre-order your book, you'll get some pretty hardcore, amazing extra bonuses and gifts. And at the same time, you will help us plant what we hope to become a good life forest. We are on a mission to plant 10,000 trees as part of bringing this book to life. And I would love your help. I'd be so grateful for it. So if you want to learn more about how to get your copy of the book, or maybe become an ambassador, actually, we have an amazing ambassador experience as well, and also help us plant trees, plant that good life forest, check out all the details at goodlifeproject.com/book, or you can just go ahead and click on the link in the show notes now. Thanks so much. I'm Jonathan Fields. On to our show.
Life has problems, like, get used to it, you know, just decide which ones are useful and important and which ones are just a distraction.
So before we get into today's guest, just a quick, not a warning, but just letting you know that there is adult language in this conversation. Now, some of you may find that offensive, but actually what you'll find is that about halfway through the conversation, we actually get into a conversation about the use of that language, why it's there, what the purpose is, what some of the misconceptions are, why today's guest actually chose very deliberately to use words like the F word and stuff like that. And I think it's a conversation that actually is worth listening to. If, again, though, you are completely offended and you don't want to be exposed to that, probably just listen until next week's episode. But my guest this week is Mark Manson. Mark has been writing I guess you could consider it a blog, although he tends to write these long and deep philosophical essays. But one thing that you'll notice about those essays is that every once in a while, they will be laden with vulgarity. And the interesting thing is, he doesn't do it because he's lazy. He does it very tactically and strategically, and there's a specific reason for it. He made it onto my radar, I want to say a couple of years ago, when he came out with an essay. And the title of that essay was The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And that has now turned into a book, which is being published. And I got curious as he expanded on that philosophy. I got curious about a lot of what he was writing about his life. And again, I got curious about his writing voice, why he chooses to actually incorporate some really big, deep ideas and some really important conversations, conversations that I think would and should be had by a lot of people, and couch them in a very strong voice, a voice that is clearly designed to fiercely attract some people and fiercely repel others. So we get deep into that conversation and into him as a writer and the choices that he's made. And so I'm really excited to share that and to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields. This is Good Life Project.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com mintmobile.com/host.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss.
Where were you right before New York?
I was in Brazil, actually.
Were you living there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Tell me, what was that? What was that about?
So I actually first went down there in 2012.
Right.
And then my fiance is Brazilian. Mm-hmm. So I stayed there for a little while and then I left. She and I kept in touch and I got pulled back and then I lived there on and off up until last year. And then, we got engaged last year and it was like, okay, we need to start figuring out like green card process and all this stuff. So we went back there, to do like a lot of wedding planning and just logistical stuff and then basically preparing for like the permanent move here.
Right.
This year, yeah.
So as the world has been focusing on Brazil for the last 2 weeks, you guys are like, we want nothing to do.
It's bittersweet, you know? I think it's easier for me because I'm not Brazilian, so it's easier for me to just detach and just feel like, oh, it's Brazil being Brazil. Yeah. But it's fun and kind of, you know, watching her on these emotional highs and lows with the Olympics and everything. It was the same with the World Cup. And the country is, it's an interesting place. It's full of extremes, you know, extreme good and extreme bad at the same time.
Yeah, it's funny because in a weird way, a lot of people would probably say that about the United States these days, but probably for different reasons.
Yeah.
Have you found, because you've traveled a lot.
Yeah.
Some 60 countries or something like that.
Right.
I'm curious, have you, and you're somebody who, like, you know, from my sense, have you really just kind of like observes your environment and how people interact with each other?
Yeah.
This has always been a curiosity of mine, so I'm going to pick your brain a little bit.
Okay, sure.
It's been in a lot of cultures. If there was a scale on how much like people emote.
Yeah.
And you were going to rank the United States compared to, you know, like these 60 other countries, what do you think would happen? Would we be at the top, the bottom, the middle?
I would say somewhere in the middle. Yeah. And I would say, but I would say for Anglo/Western European cultures, we're towards the top.
Huh.
People are a little bit more subdued in, you know, if you go to like Ireland or Scotland or Scandinavia. But in the grand scheme of things, it's the Latino cultures, the African cultures, definitely like. They make us look like a bunch of boars.
But I mean, often I think that that's an amazing thing to be able to just sort of like let whatever's in your heart pour out. And we just like stomp that down so much.
Yeah. I really fell in love with Latin culture for that reason.
Huh.
You know, and I grew up in a family that was pretty emotionally stifled.
Right.
It wasn't acceptable to express too much. And so when I discovered Latin culture, especially once I started to learn the languages a little bit, it was just this breath of fresh air. Yeah. Like, it was just like, oh my God, how have I been living without this my whole life? But it's interesting because then you spend more time in it and you start to realize that there's kind of like there's a downside of that too. Like I have a saying that I always tell people. I say the best thing about a country or a culture is also the worst thing. And so if you take like Americans, like the United States, we're extremely driven, extremely ambitious. we're very good at business. We have all these beliefs about, like, you know, anybody can work and be successful and everybody deserves like free enterprise and everything. And in many ways, that's the best thing about our culture. It's the thing that we've contributed to the world. But at the same time, it also creates all of our problems, is that, like, we look at poor and homeless people and we're like, oh, well, that guy's lazy. He needs to go get a job. And it creates a lot of, like, very kind of superficial aspects of the culture. Yeah. And everything's a sales job and people are very transactional in their relationships. And the same applies with, I think, the emotional stuff. You know, what I love about Brazil and my friends and my fiance's family down there is just that, like, things are just so loving and open and warm. And it's, you know, if somebody's happy, they're just happy with you. And if something bad happens, they're just sad with you. And it's a really beautiful thing. But then the downside of that is that things don't really get done because people are just like, well, you know, we've got this project coming up, but, you know, it's so beautiful outside. Like, why don't we just, let's take off work early and go to the beach, you know? And then they get to the beach and they're like, oh, well, let's have some caipirinhas. And then, you know, they have this great time. And then they, next thing you know, 3 weeks have gone by and that project's still not finished.
Right.
And like, there's a cool part of that, but it's, you know, when the whole society is operating on that way, you know, things just break down constantly.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably make a similar argument. It's almost like the East Coast, West Coast thing in the United States. It's like, you know, you go to, I mean, because I know friends who are kind of hardcore entrepreneurs and business people on the East Coast, and then they go to the West Coast, especially Southern California.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, so people, we're hiring people, but they're not actually showing up. And I shouldn't make big sweeping generalizations. I'm sorry, everybody. I just insulted everybody in Southern California.
Yeah, right.
So I'm completely sorry about that. They're awesome, industrious people in Southern California.
Working but, so hard with their surfboards.
Exactly. But it begs a bigger question, though, right? Because and that is, okay, so if you take it to the most extreme that you were saying, if literally sort of that – you know, like, such is life, enjoy the moment attitude makes it so that there's, you know, that people are just so much more there and present and enjoying the moment. But at the same time, on almost like, you know, countrywide level, like industriousness and stuff doesn't happen. Is that a bad thing?
Yes. I mean, I think a society can function with a certain amount of that, and maybe even a certain amount of that inefficiency is healthy for it. Mm. I think the ideal middle is I really wish I could take the best thing parts about Latin culture and the best parts about U.S. culture and just merge them into this like mythical, amazing right. country. 'Cause the problem in Latin America is, so yes, it's nice to have that attitude. And, you know, when it comes to certain maybe industries or projects, like it's fine to be like, you know what, if it's a few weeks late, it's not a big problem. But the problem in Latin America is like their infrastructure is failing. Mm. The police are not reliable. The legal system's not reliable. The politicians aren't reliable, you know. And once you start getting into that, it's you know, everything starts to kind of break down.
Yeah, I guess like you said, there's the light side and the dark side of everything. Like there's no, you got to kind of embrace it all until you figure out how to make that humanoid clone of like the best of. The best of all things. But according to, I think, your philosophy, like that perfect person, that perfect existence would also be maybe the worst thing that could end up happening.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it can exist. I think it's, there's no, I mean, and I talk about this in my book, like there's no such thing as a problem-free life. You know, it's about picking your, life's about picking your problems. Which problems do you want? You know, and some problems are better for others, you know, objectively. Some problems are better for others based on their personality or their preferences, their values. But I think really it's, you know, one of the central themes of the book is like, stop avoiding problems, choose the problems you want, choose the problems that are important, invigorate you, make you feel inspired, give your life meaning.
Yeah, which is the exact opposite of what so many people think of, which is to avoid all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. You, one of the things you talk about is suffering. It's something that I'm deeply fascinated in.
Yeah.
And it's funny. You know, so I'm reading your book and you start telling this story, a parable about a guy, and I'm like three sentences on. Like, I know who this is.
Yeah.
Even though it takes like three pages to reveal it, and it ends up being the Buddha.
Right.
But take me deeper into your understanding of suffering and maybe some of the what you feel are some of the misunderstandings around it and where the value really is.
Sure. Buddhism has been very influential on my life. And one of the things I like about Buddhism is I feel like it's much more realistic in terms of, like, you know, like, for lack of a better term, like, life is shit. You know, it's like everything kind of sucks, but that's okay. You know, like, we're not here to, like, fix everything. We're here to just be with it and get comfortable with it. And so in the book, I talk about how it's, you know, basically that's like the first tenet of Buddhism is that life is suffering. You know, everything you experience in your life will cause some form of suffering or another. And the Buddha, you know, I don't get too deep in it, but, you know, in Buddhism, it has to do with attachment and attaching yourself to different ideas or feelings or emotions or whatever. I kind of take like a different left turn or something when I talk about it. And that I just say that, you know, suffering, pain in general, it evolved for a reason. You know, it's not, pain is not this like horrible accident that was just kind of thrust upon humanity. Like, we evolved over millions of years with a pain system in our body for a reason. And it's a feedback mechanism that tells us that we're doing something that's not healthy or not good for us. And the argument I make in the book is that therefore we should not ignore it, because if we become very adept at ignoring pain or shutting pain out or distracting ourselves from pain, then we're not getting that necessary feedback that we need to maintain a healthy, stable life.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges that people have with that idea, and it's funny, you know, like, I've gone fairly deep down the Buddhism rabbit hole too, and a lot of the philosophy really resonates with me as well.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate to have many friends who are, you know, have followed different paths and been able to have these like great conversations. The idea that we actually need pain to be there, that it has value, that
yeah.
it's not something that we, like, you shouldn't spend your life trying to remove all occurrences of pain, but actually not necessarily invite it, but know that, like, it's okay if it's there, and
yeah.
and it actually needs to be there, and that there's value, and that actually a life completely devoid of pain, which a lot of people think they want, is
right.
actually not a life that you want.
Yeah. Because then it would be meaningless. There's nothing to strive for. There's nothing to struggle for. There's nothing to accomplish. There's nothing to move towards. There'd be no sense of purpose if everything just felt good all the time. You know, it's like if you imagine like a heroin addict, you know, like and I think I even use that example in the book, is like, yeah, there's a word we have for people who just chase pleasure all the time. And it's like hedonism. It's a heroin addict. It's a drug addict, you know, and if you see those people, they've become controlled by this, just like chasing this feeling over and over again.
Yeah.
You know?
So I guess the question is, if you accept the fact that a certain amount of suffering, a certain amount of pain is there, and there's value in that, you know, mm-hmm. like, what do you do with that? Where do you go from there so that you can, yeah? Because how do you extract the value from the pain, from the suffering?
I think the first step is you need to decide what the pain means. And that's such a simple thing to say, but
yeah.
it's like you could go so many
right.
different directions with that. And actually, probably the majority of the book is just about that. Like, what does your pain mean? Like, what are you deciding your pain means? How are you measuring success and failure for yourself? That's a hard process. That requires a lot of self-questioning, requires either discovering or getting back to your personal values, like understanding, like, what you've decided is important for you. Mm. And that's an extremely personal and difficult thing for a lot of people to do, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I think it's a process that most of us run from.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't even think it's a process we run from. I think it's a process we've never been taught or encouraged to learn.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. And so we've never learned how to like get good at it, or like, you know, we're all kind of figuring it out as we
yeah.
go. And I think the other difficulty is that it's a process that never completely ends.
Mm.
It's something that's always evolved. Like our the meaning of our suffering and the meaning of our problems it's always changing as our life goes on. And so we have to continually reevaluate, ask ourselves the same question year after year after year.
Yeah, we don't like that.
No, no, we want like final solutions. Right, like I want to take a pill and be happy.
Can we just lock this down now? Yeah. It's like, okay, I checked the box. I know myself. We're good, right? but it's I think culturally we're so uncomfortable with the notion that it's a process that never ends.
Yeah,
but I think that's also my sense is that that's something that's relatively unique to Western society.
Yeah.
What do you think?
My observation is I think consumerism, for all of its problems, it definitely has kind of a psychological side effect on us in that it kind of conditions us to just want immediate resolution to our problems or our desires, you know? So it's, I mean, if you, pretty much every commercial advertisement ever made, it's like, you know, feel bad about your body, buy this, you know, feel bad about, are you hungry, buy this, you know? And it's just this simple, like, two-step, feel pain, buy something, problem solves process. And I think that kind of just, like, gets inculcated into us and we get kind of fixated on it and we don't. And so, yeah, and I mean, you could probably talk about the education system as well, where everything is kind of like a definitive, like, performance-based or result-based. But yeah, I find that process, you know, some people describe it as like a process-oriented mentality and a result-oriented mentality. I think a lot of, like, just the structures in Western society is based on results, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's goal-striving.
Yeah, it's all clearly measured, but there are many aspects of our psychology that it's always it's a process oriented.
Like, give me an example.
Well, I mean, if you just take, happiness in general,
right?
You know, like, there's no single thing in your life or my life that we will ever do that will, it's like, okay, happiness accomplished, you know, end of, like, I'm done. You know, I'm going to go retire. You know, it's the things that make us feel great today are often the same things that drive us crazy next week or next year. And just the way our brains work is that happiness requires action. It requires change. It requires, like, this process of, I guess, evolving. You know, it's moving the goalpost back repeatedly. It's just the way our brain works. And, you know, these things in society, it's not built that way. And so you get a lot of situations where, you know, you have people who are worth $20 million who feel like they haven't made enough money yet. And you get people who own six BMWs who feel like they need to buy a seventh. And so there's a little bit of an inconsistency there.
Yeah. I so agree with that. I think, and there's great research around that too. And you talk about it, I talk about it as well, about the more you actually maniacally pursue happiness, as a general rule, the less, the more miserable you become over time. It's counterintuitive, but actually it kind of makes sense when you really deconstruct it.
Yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight-up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The
all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is sponsored by Wonderful Pistachios. So listen up, all you busy bosses running around town, fueling your days with sad desk snacks. This is a PSA that it's time to give your afternoon pick-me-up a super yummy and very crunch-tastic makeover with Wonderful Pistachios. I'm talking 6 grams of complete plant-based protein packed into every satisfyingly crackable, crunchable ounce. That's all 9 essential amino acids. So whether you're an old school roasted and salted fan, which is kind of me actually, or you like to walk your taste buds over to the wild side with jalapeno lime, Wonderful Pistachios have a flavor for every craving. And if you don't want to crack shells, which I happen to love doing for some odd reason, Wonderful Pistachios no shells let you skip the mess and get right to the fun. So do yourself a favor, pistachio people. Make your snacks more nutritious and delicious with the protein punch of Wonderful Pistachios. Your 3 p.m. hunger pangs and taste buds will thank you. And quit settling for those sad desk snacks. You deserve better. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com and get cracking.
But you were kind of alluding to something also. I want to go a little bit deeper into, which is the idea of sort of like rating your happiness in comparison to others around you.
Oh, yeah.
You have this great sort of like set of contrasting stories, Dave Mustaine and Pete Best.
Yeah.
Can you share that a little bit and why you brought those two up in relation to each other?
So, yeah, I'm a huge rock music fanatic, nerd and everything. And I love these two stories. So Dave Mustaine, he was actually the original guitarist of Metallica. And literally like the week before, a couple weeks before, Metallica was going to record their very first album. The rest of the guys in the band just woke him up from a hangover and were like, hey, dude, you're out of the band, and gave him a bus ticket to go home. And there was like no explanation. There was no like argument about it. It was just, he was done. He was out. And he was devastated by this. And he got very upset and angry, and he decided when he got home that he resolved that he was going to start the biggest, best, most badass metal band the world had ever seen. And he went out and found better musicians than the Metallica guys, and he started a band called Megadeth, which actually went on to sell like 30 million records, toured the world, played stadium crowds, guy made millions of dollars. It's really fascinating because about 10 years ago, there was a documentary made about Metallica, and they interviewed Dave Mustaine, and he actually broke down in the interview and was like, I still feel like a failure because I'm still, despite all of like the platinum records and everything that I've done, I'm still the guy who got kicked out of Metallica, you know? And what I love about that story too is that by a lot of the conventional wisdom in our culture, Dave Mustaine did everything right. You know, like it's suffered adversity. And so he resolved that he was going to come back better and stronger than ever. And he was going to succeed no matter what. And he did it. He like accomplished everything he wanted to do. But what I say in the book is that the problem is that he wasn't measuring himself by being a successful musician anymore. Once he got kicked out of Metallica, he started measuring himself by, am I better than Metallica? Mm. And because of that, no matter how many millions of records he sold, he would never be better than them.
Right. And Metallica, by the way, which has sold 180, 200 million.
Yeah. I mean, they're like arguably like right. arguably one of the biggest bands
right, ever
that have ever existed. And then Pete Best. So there's a really odd kind of parallel if you go back to like the 1960s. So Pete Best was the original drummer of the Beatles. And eerily similar story. Beatles were about to record their first album. About a month before the recording, the Beatles didn't even want to do it themselves. So John, Paul, and George went and told their manager, they're like, hey, kick Pete out of the band. And the manager was like, why? Pete's great. Like, Actually, apparently back then, Pete was the only like responsible one who like showed up for rehearsal and like wasn't doing drugs. So like the manager was like, wait, why do you guys want to get rid of Pete? Come on, like he's a nice guy. And like, no, get rid of Pete. So a couple weeks before the recording started, the manager kicked Pete out and they went and got Ringo. And Pete went through pretty much the opposite of Dave Mustaine. Like he tried to start other bands. They failed miserably. The Beatles were not very gracious with him. Apparently, they like talked really badly about him in the media. They like made fun of him and said that he was a terrible musician and all this stuff. And he became incredibly depressed and almost suicidal. And again, if you jump ahead like 20, 30 years later, he, in an interview, he said, getting kicked out of the Beatles is one of the best things that ever happened to me. And his line of reasoning was it forced him out of kind of like this transient music life down another career path. He was still involved in the music industry, but he wasn't like a touring musician. And he met his wife. He had kids. He had a family. Actually built a very successful life doing like music engineering, studio production, things like that. And he said, yeah, actually like, now I'm pretty glad I got kicked out because, you know, he's like, I would never have privacy again. Like I would, my family life would be all screwed up. I wouldn't have met my wife. And so I think that's a beautiful contrast to Mustaine because it shows that really the only thing that changed is Pete Best just changed how he was measuring himself. Well, I think he started out trying to be better than the Beatles and that quickly made him really depressed. And then once he realized that he couldn't do that, he needed to go find a new way to measure what success or meaning was in his life. And he found that. And he actually lived a very happy and healthy life.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting, too, because objectively, if you looked at those two stories side by side, right, and you asked them without having heard like those final things from either of them, and you're like, who's more successful?
Yeah.
You know, like probably almost everyone would point to Mustaine.
Right.
You know, like start, you know, like the second best, you know, like metal band ever and yeah. all this stuff because we define success. So kind of weirdly, whereas in truth, you know, like he was torturing himself and he was miserable. But that experience is not unique to him. I mean, there's really interesting research on sort of like comparison and how it destroys us.
Yeah.
You know, have you seen this studies done where it kind of shows that, ask people, like, would you rather make, I'm making up the numbers here, but the point is the same. You can either make $75,000 and know that, you know, all of your friends and colleagues are making $100,000, or you can make $50,000 but be making $25,000 more than everybody right. else that you know. And like they chose the lower number
right.
as long as they knew they were making more than everybody else around yeah. them, because we're so wired to try and derive satisfaction through comparison. Rather than just like something yeah. more internal.
Yeah.
We're weird that way.
I mean, it's almost like a curse. And I mean, I definitely fall into the school of thought that, like, I don't think you can get rid of comparison. Like, I think, like you said, we're wired for it. And for me, the question is what we, because that it's such a precarious thing, because if we start comparing ourselves with everybody around us, we're just going to end up on this like treadmill taking us to nowhere. For me, it's like, okay, if we have to compare ourselves to something, like, then we need to be very careful about what we decide to compare ourselves to. Like, how are we going to decide? Like, what is the standard that we're going to set for ourselves? Is it going to be selling more albums than Metallica, or is it going to be having happy, healthy relationships in our life? You know, it's like we get to decide what those comparisons are, and we get to choose how we measure ourselves, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that you tend to focus on also yeah. is what to care about and what not to care about.
Yeah.
That's the fundamental part of your philosophy. Yeah.
What to give a fuck about, what
exactly.
not to give a fuck
right?
about.
Right, it's like yeah. that's, at bottom line, like that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Tell me more, a little bit more about that. So you first came onto my radar, it was probably a couple of years ago when I guess you wrote the essay that eventually turned into your book,
okay.
or at least like the beginning parts of your book, which is
right.
the same name as your book.
Yeah.
Which had one of the most brilliant top panels ever, by the way.
The
you guys have to check this out. Yeah, it's like the entire screen is just like it's a photo of a cat just kind of walking out with this giant explosion behind it, and the title of the post is like the subtle art of not giving a fuck, and you're just like, what? It's this like crazy pattern interrupt. You're like, there's no way that you can just tab past that without having to go further. Yeah. The blend of that was brilliant. But what inspired? Clearly, you had something to get off your chest, and that persisted with you until you expanded into something much bigger.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I started writing this book about 6 months before that article, and I knew from the beginning that I wanted to write kind of a self-help book or a personal development book that, you know, I wanted to come at things from not trying to gain more of everything, but trying to, you know, a self-help book based on having less, simplifying your life, like getting rid of all like the extraneous distractions and stuff. And I wanted to talk about a lot of these things about like how, you know, life has problems, like get used to it, you know, just decide which ones are useful and important, which ones are just a distraction. And I'd been kind of hammering on these concepts for a while. Like I had a good outline. I had a bunch of like kind of rough drafts of chapters and stuff. And it was like a really crappy winter day. And sometimes I just get in these very like irreverent moods where I just want to be like flippant and say like just absurd things on my blog. And I probably have one or two posts a year that I just go nuts. And I had always had this idea, like I've got a sheet where I keep my article ideas, and I just had an idea for a title, and it was called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And I just always thought that was like an awesome title. And so on this like gray afternoon, I was like, you know what? I'm going to write an article and I'm going to say the word fuck as many times as I can. Like the whole goal of the article is to just say fuck, but I'm not just going to do that. Like, I'm not just going to be like crude and vulgar. Like, I want to also try to combine it with like really, really good life advice so that just people won't know what to do with it. Like, they'll find this disgusting, vulgar article that like is just saying these like really gross things, but then the information itself will actually be very like powerful and useful. And so I was like, okay, that sounds like fun. And so I started writing it, and I got to the end, and I remember reading over the draft, and I'm like, this is absolutely ridiculous. Like, this is... So I always send my articles to my assistant before I post them and just kind of get his feedback. And I sent it to him. I'm like, all right, man, this one's a little bit weird. I don't know if anybody... Like, I don't even know if we should post this. And he's like, okay, I'll take a look. And he comes back like 15 minutes later and he said, look, man, you can fire me. I'm posting this. He's like, I don't care what you say. Like, we have to post this. There's nothing you can do to stop me from posting it. I was like, okay. And he went and found the cat picture and everything. And so we posted it, and just, it went nuts. I think it ended up with like 7 million page views, 8 million page views, something insane like that.
Touched a nerve.
Yeah. And that's when, and I had already been wrestling with a lot of these ideas and how to express them. And it's like those early drafts of the book too, they were very like kind of intellectual and philosophical. And I would show sections to people and they'd be like, well, this is interesting, but it's really dry and boring. And so when I hit this article, I was like, okay, this is how it needs to be. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Like, if you're basically going to write a self-help book that's all about like pain, just like get used to your pain. You're not that special, you know, like it needs to be written in a very fun way that like can keep the reader like enjoying what they're reading. Cause a lot of the stuff, I think a lot of the stuff, it's hard for people to hear.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me cause there's, So I've been reading your stuff since I found it a couple of years ago, and then I read the book, and I've had this conversation with a number of people over the years who are writers, and also just people who are readers and blog readers, stuff like that. And it's about dropping F-bomb. It's about, you know, like just using language in your writing.
Yeah.
And like I'm sure at this point you have had this these arguments ad nauseum too.
Right.
About, you know, is it laziness? Is it just like, what are you trying to do with it? You can make the exact same point without it. And it's interesting. As I'm reading your book, I don't know if this was intentional, but there's actually a progression in your book. of like, if you analyze, if you did sort of like an F-bomb count per page from the first page to the end,
yeah.
at least it felt to me like the first quarter was loaded.
Yeah.
The next, and like as you go through the book, it drops away and drops away and drops away. Almost like, I almost got the feeling like, okay, he's using them deliberately
yeah.
to just like shake me and to startle me and try and just keep rattling me long enough so that I keep reading enough of these ideas
yeah.
so that I start to ask deeper questions. And then it's almost like once, if I get to a point in, you know, where I'm still reading, then it's almost like you feel there's almost like less of a need
yeah.
to keep doing those pattern interrupts. So now you drop into more straight philosophy and stories and stuff yeah. like that. Was that deliberate?
It wasn't. It was definitely deliberate in the first couple chapters.
Yeah.
I knew that the first two chapters in particular are like the most kind of irreverent
yeah.
and just like very aggressive.
In your face, yeah.
yeah, they're very aggressive. And I was very conscious of doing that for a lot of the reasons you said. And I've discovered this over the years with my blog too. Because like I've gotten complaints about my language for years and years and years and years. And so I've sat down with myself many times and said, you know, do I really need to use this language? Is it helping me? Is there a reason to keep doing it? And I eventually came to the conclusion that yes. And I think what you summarized it perfectly. It's a way to shake up people's attention, you know, because people who are reading self-development advice online, like at this point, we've all read like 5,000 articles that say like more or less similar things. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like there's any, a lot of times it's not like people really need to be taught something new. The problem is, it's just like, they know what to do. They're just not doing it. And I think a big part of that is just people get too comfortable. They're stuck in their comfort zone. They like their day to day. And so it's fun to like kind of read this stuff, but they don't actually ever let themselves experience the discomfort of having to consider it. And so I try to kind of use the vulgarity as like a hammer to like chip away at that comfort. Mm. You know, it's like if I can just throw in a joke that makes you really uncomfortable reading it, and then hit you with like a difficult personal question immediately after, like I feel like it makes it easier for a lot of people to like to go to that place because they're already uncomfortable
you know,
from the joke or whatever. That was definitely at play in the book. And then the other thing about the book too, and I had conversations with my editor about this, is that a lot of the deeper philosophical stuff is towards the back.
Right.
And my editor told me, there was some rearranging that went on, and my editor told me, he said, look, like, this stuff is great, but he said, you've got to earn it. Like, you can't just, like, throw out questions about people thinking about their own death, like, in the middle of chapter 3. He's like, you got to build up to this, man. Like, you can't just, you know, like, just open up the whole Pandora's box to begin with.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it is. I mean, it is really interesting, because for you, it's not laziness, because you definitely have, you have an ability with words, and you've been writing for a number of years now. You know, it's very tactical.
Yeah.
But I think if you haven't read enough of you, you probably don't realize that.
Yeah.
You know, I think eventually you're like, oh, he's using it for very specific reasons in a specific way in a specific place. Yeah. You know, but if you just kind of land on something, like, you will immediately be, you know, either fiercely repelled or fiercely drawn in. Like, there's no middle reaction to some of these things.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
But it's interesting to hear you say that, yeah, it actually is tactical. It's specific. It kind of reminds me. Have you seen the documentary that's floating around now, that the Tony Robbins documentary?
I've not yet. I want to see it.
So it's like, you know, it's basically, it's a documentary that kind of follows this, you know, his 6 or 7 day thing. And he drops F-bombs left and right.
You know?
And it's for the exact same. And people have said to me, and I've had this conversation, they're like, oh my God, I never knew he was so vulgar. I'm so offended. And I'm like, if you actually zoom the lens out and look at what he's doing, it's entirely tactical, as sort of like trying to interrupt behavior. And you can argue about whether and when that's appropriate in the context of a particular conversation or intervention or person.
Right.
But you actually, like, it's not that he just has, you know, like a potty mouth. It's that he's doing it in a very deliberate, strategic way.
Yeah.
And I get the same sensibility with you.
Yeah. I actually wrote an article a couple years ago called Why I Have a Potty Mouth.
Nah.
And it was just because I got so many complaints from so many people that I finally, I was like, I need to, like,
just lay it out there.
Yeah. I just put my sword in the line, put the line in the stand or whatever. And it's interesting. I did some, you know, when all these issues were coming up, I did some research about, like, where vulgarity comes from. Because it's very interesting that, you know, tying it back in the cultures, like, every culture, every language has profanity. And so it's not something that's just unique to our history or our culture or the English language. Like, it's a natural thing that's ingrained into us. And it exists everywhere. And so then the next question becomes, like, okay, why do we have that? And the theory goes is that, basically, societies kind of rope off a group of words, and it changes as the generations go by.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Things that, you know, the word fuck was, like, not considered vulgar at all. And then there was a really funny one. I think it was, like, the word impale or something like that was, like, extremely vulgar in, like, the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, it was the equivalent of, like, fuck. That was extremely crude, you know, back then. And now it's just, like, another random word. But anyway, like, we always kind of, like, rope off these groups of words and just all agree that, like, okay, those were bad words. And the reason is that it creates social cohesion, because it's like, and it allows us to, like, that shock value that happens when something is said, like, it provides value in communication. It provides value within the culture. Like, it is a signifier of, like, this is something that is of high intensity or importance or requires extra attention. And so, yeah, there's, like, to me, it's just, it makes sense. And I understand that it's going to alienate a large group of people, but, you know, for my style and for how I like to communicate, and, like, I like to leverage it, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but, like, I think one of my big,
This show is basically back to tangent.
Yeah, the whole show is just one big tangent.
Yeah,
okay.
It's all good.
You know, one of my big inspirations growing up, I was huge, like, George Carlin fan.
Yeah.
And there was another guy named Bill Hicks that I loved too.
Right.
And what I loved about them is that they were crude and hilarious, but, like, Carlin especially, like, he would make, like, really profound,
deep social commentary.
Yeah, like, really interesting critiques. And you would just be laughing so hard while he did it. And I've just always really admired that. And I think I took a lot of inspiration from that.
Yeah. Well, so Carlin's, it was like his famous, like, 7 dirty words.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, that's, like, the bit that I think kind of, like, you know, like, everyone just kind of got to know him by, you know, at least for me, actually, that's where I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I'm telling all my friends, you know, and then I remember at some point, like, years later, I literally remember, like, the first time I heard one of his 7 dirty words on TV.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, culture has changed,
hasn't
it?
Yeah.
You know? And so it is interesting, because, like, what you were saying before, it's like, you know, the things that are vulgar and disgusting and unaccepted, it's just that all shifts over time. I have a friend of mine who's deep into Shakespeare. done a lot of research around this and deeply involved in sort of like the Shakespearean societies and stuff like that. And saying, actually, if you look at the language that was used, a lot of the language that we don't really understand or doesn't do anything to us now actually were, you know, the functional equivalents of all these, you know, like swear Bulgaria. Words.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Back in his time, and it was just part of, you know, like what was woven into the stories.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, but it is really interesting because the single biggest argument that's every once in a long while I drop stuff into my writing, but as a general rule, I don't. But what's interesting is it's deliberate with me not to, because I write way more cleanly than I speak.
Yeah.
If I'm hanging out with my friends, I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
You know, I have a number of friends that will, you know, like basically, you know, like they use four-letter words as commas and sentences, right. You know, and at certain times, if I'm riled up, I will too.
Yeah.
And so I have to make a very deliberate, and there are times where I just want to let loose, and there every once in a while I do, and I get a lot of either, wow, that was amazing, or, you know, like I'm never reading a thing that you write again. That
it's
was
polarizing.
Massively disrespectful. And so you have to be willing to be that lightning rod, you know, that both attracts and repels in a really strong way.
Yeah.
And sort of like stand in that and say, yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to go there, there yet, but it's amazing to me. So I'm always fascinated by people who are what's underneath it. And also like really getting clear of the fact that this is not laziness with language.
Yeah.
This is that, deliberate strategic use.
And that bugs me. Like I understand, you know, so I get a lot of emails from people who are like, I wish I could show this article to my kids, or I'm a high school teacher. I would love to assign this to my students, but I can't because of this and that. That I get that, and I that's what I feel like I'm missing out on, or what I'm giving up by using this. But yeah, what drives me crazy is when you get kind of these like cranky grandmothers who are like, you know, if you can't say it without the F word, then you're too stupid to say it at all, or you know, whatever. And it's it's just a lack of understanding that like that profanity, like words have meaning, like they exist for a reason, and their meaning exists for a reason. And
at the same time, I think there are also plenty of examples of people who use words because they're and who aren't using them tactically or strategically.
Yeah.
It's not because it's the right word to like describe an emotion or something that's being felt, like, and there's no other word to describe it. It's that they're just like, there is a certain amount of laziness or just, you know, not a lack of craft.
Yeah. And they just want attention.
So people want to lump everybody into the same basket, you know? So I can understand the arguments on both sides, but it's something that I'm sort of like constantly dancing with and exploring. But there are also times where I've written, you know, I told a story once about this moment that I experienced in an elevator where, like, one person who was in deep pain and clearly very ill turned to her parent after getting really bad news and just whispered, you know, like in her mom's ear, she's like, fuck. There's no way to tell that story using any other word. It was what was actually said.
Right, right.
But B, there's no other word that expresses that emotion.
Yeah.
That in that window of time, there is just, you know, like, oh, damn, or
it's shucks.
Right, it's not going to, not what was being felt. And that's the biggest thing for me is if what you're feeling like bone deep in that moment is that, then to use another word because you don't want to offend is doing a disservice.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not conveying the truth of the story that you're trying to tell or the message or a real life scenario that unfolded, and you diminish the power of it at the same time. So it's a really interesting line that I'm always sort of like exploring as a writer. There's another curiosity around, because you consider yourself, I mean, you don't just write as like a side thing. You're a writer.
Right.
Right. And you've written that, you know, a number of years back, you kind of realized that after trying a zillion different things, one of the things that you seem to be decent at and you really decide to focus on is you can write. And so writing is something that I'm assuming you kind of hold dear, that you really value. You know, you as a writer, do you get concerned ever that you don't know whether people are responding to the integrity of the message versus the provocation of the package that it's wrapped in? As a writer, to try and figure out, like, are my ideas really landing?
Mm-hmm. I think the reactions for me, they kind of land on two different levels. So there is that kind of more superficial level of like, oh, cool, this article got a lot of Facebook likes, or, you know, or I got a lot of traffic from this one, you know, and that's pleasing. Like, it's obviously, it always feels good to see things read and passed around. But, you know, for me, it's like the baseline or what I really kind of look at to determine, I guess, whether, you know, my measuring stick for whether I did a good job really comes from like the reader reaction themselves. So, like the emails I get, there's kind of a core readership that follows me very vocally. And so I look at what they're saying, what their responses are. A lot of people send me stories of like how certain things affected them. Mm-hmm. So I get kind of a sense like which articles are really hitting a nerve with people and which ones are not. And the interesting thing is that, you know, those two layers, sometimes they happen together. So like with this, the article that spawned this book, it happened, they both happened together with that one. So I got a flood of people coming in, probably just because they saw the cat picture and the word fuck in the title. And they're like, okay, gotta click on this. But I also got a flood of people who are like, wow, like I never thought about this before. Like, this is amazing. But there are other articles where I get that flood of attention, but I don't get that flood of like people going, oh wow, this is like, this really affected me on a deep level. So those articles I can kind of look at and be like, all right, that was a little bit more sizzle than steak.
Yeah. And you would rather have the emails that say this mattered.
Yeah. If I had to only have one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would rather have that. I go for both, but, you know, I try to cast a very wide net. I guess I go for breadth and depth at the same time, but sometimes you only get one. And if I had to choose one, I would just choose depth.
Yeah. Even though it would also very likely narrow your audience a lot.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, well, this is kind of getting more into the nitty gritty of writing, but like, I feel like it's much easier to take something that's deep and kind of package it in a way that's exciting and catches attention, you know, cause that's almost like quasi marketing at that point, you know. It's like, and I have tons of blog ideas that like, it's a really nerdy idea, you right. know, like it's super intellectual and dorky, and I spend time kind of like, all right, like what language can I put around this that like, you know, the average person on the street will like read it and understand it and be interested in it. So there's that aspect of it. I think doing that is easier than creating depth where there isn't any.
Yeah. What was interesting, though, is that like the story you told about where this original essay and then eventually the book came from was, and it's funny because I do this too, is you just had a title that you fell in love with. And I did, like, I have a running list of titles. I'm like, someday I'm going to figure out what to write underneath that title.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I'm not going to waste it because it's so good. So, like, it may take years, but someday I'll figure out, like, something worthy of that title to write.
Yep.
And so, in a way, you could call that like a marketing-driven essay, but in the truth, it's not, because you just know that there's something about the title that is just that conveys so much. Like, it's the right words. It just, like, you know, it's beautifully. It just says so much.
Well, with this one, so yeah, this one sat around. This title sat around for over a year, and the feeling I get with that situation is I feel like I remember, like, I was like, this is such a good title. I need to think of something that deserves it.
Yeah.
You know, like I can't write this article until I find the ideas that are good enough to match how good it is.
You know? It also reminds me of like the 100 URLs that I have reserved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like someday, I had a business that where, my last actually brick and mortar company that I owned, where I actually reserved the URL a couple of years before. And I wasn't sure why. I was just like, this is good. And someday I'm going to do something with it. And I actually ended up building an entire company around it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But I think sometimes we get those hits of things where, like, we're not sure what it's, but, like, we kind of, like, we know something has to happen around it. We're hanging out literally on the verge of this book coming out. By the time this airs, actually, it'll be like, right about out. Why a book? You know, because you've got a tremendous audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have total freedom to write what you want to write. People are responding to you. You're able to support yourself. So why a book?
I think I mean, first and foremost, like, I love books. Like, I genuinely, you know, you were asking me before we started recording about podcasts. And, yeah. And like I said, like, I dabble in podcasts. I download a few episodes of this guy here, a few of there, you know, and like you, I've probably listened to 5 or 6 of your interviews. I couldn't even, they were probably spaced so far apart. Right. I wouldn't even know, you know. It's just like, I see something interesting. I'm like, okay, I'll listen to that. But like, books is like, books are the thing that I fall in love with. And so for me, there's just kind of a natural urge to pursue that, you know, because that's just kind of where my own passion lies. The other explanation is I think I'm a much better writer than I am speaker or, you know, video personality. It's something that I'm way more comfortable with, that I'm more confident in. I imagine I could, you know, if I put the time in and built up my chops, you know, doing audio or video or something, like I could probably get good at it, but it's like, I've already put in my chops writing. Yeah. You know, so
how is the process of writing books sort of surprised you? Like, what was the, coming into it, what was like one big expectation that you had where you're like, oh, that wasn't what I thought it was?
There was a really big realization for me about halfway through. And that was when I realized that the amount of time I put in per day writing was not, the input and output weren't like matched. So what that means is, when I started writing this book, it was like, all right, I'm just going to like write like a madman. And I would block off entire days and I would write for like 8 or 10 hours. And I would, you know, I'd write like 4,000 words and I'm like, oh, come on, let's get to 5,000. And I would just like push myself the power through, get the 5,000 or whatever. And I was just like, I was like treating myself like a workhorse. And it took me months to figure out, because in the early stages of this book, like, it was just, it was kind of a disaster. Like, it was just disorganized and all over the place. And I kept having to like delete stuff and rewrite it and delete stuff and rewrite it. And I finally took some time off and I kind of realized that, I don't remember where it came from. I think I was talking to a friend who's also a writer, but it occurred to me that if like the first few hours I write, I generally, you know, generally like the best stuff I produce, it comes in the first 2 to 3 hours that I'm writing. After that, you know, hour, say like 4 through 8, it's really hit and miss. And what occurred to me is that if I'm forcing myself to output like 3 or 4 hours a day of crappy writing, I'm actually like creating more work for myself. Because all that crappy writing, you got to go back through, you got to edit it, revise it, cut it, rewrite it, shift it around, redo the outline. And I realized, I was like, you know, maybe I should just go as long as I feel like I'm writing really well, and like it's coming easily and fluidly, and then just stop and just see how that goes. And what I discovered is that actually like writing maybe like 3 hours a day and then getting to that point where my brain's a little bit fried and I start like bumping into the wall, if I stop there, I'm actually way more productive than if I like force myself to power through like 8 hours a day. That was just, that blew my mind on so many levels. And it didn't even, it felt like it was unfair. Like, you know, it's like, it feels like, man, I had so much discipline. I was working so hard, you know? And it's like, now it's like, I wake up, I write until it's time to have lunch, and then I'm done for the day. And it's like, that's more efficient. This is more productive. Like, this isn't even fair.
Right. It's so kind of, it's like you wouldn't, I'm the same way. I think we're all the same way, actually. Yeah. You know, like, all the research shows that we don't actually have all that much bandwidth available for really high level creative work.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like when you're cooked, you're cooked. And and we keep pushing through because we're trained to work an 8 or a 10 or a 12 hour day. That's just the expectation. But the fact is, like, you know, the other 70% is just largely just gobbledygook.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
That, and like you were saying, it's actually worse than nothing, because then you have to go back and figure out, like, parse it to find out if there are any nuggets, and that takes additional work on top of it. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you say that. It's I'm the same way. Like, I wake up first thing and I try and do my sort of fierce creative stuff, my writing, like as early as I can, because I know I'm cooked by generally two, like for deep creative stuff by lunchtime, I'm pretty much done.
Yeah.
Like, it's over.
Yeah. And it's, it was a big lesson to learn that creative energy and just mental energy, they're not the same thing. You know, if I want to work on my website, I could do that all day, all night and still be productive. But yeah, like writing a book, writing an article, 3 hours, I'm probably almost done.
Yeah, that sounds about right for me too.
Yeah.
I want to start to come full circle. One, it's so interesting for me to have spent time reading somebody and then just hang out with you.
Yeah.
Because one of my curiosities is always, is the voice that I, because, you know, when you read an author and when you start to actually read enough of them, you start to create a persona in your head,
yeah,
of who they are and what they're about. So, and then when I get to sit down with somebody, I'm always really curious. I'm like, okay, is hanging out in person, just having a regular conversation, is he the person that I felt on the page?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. There is a certain yes to that, but there's also a certain no to me. So it's interesting to just hang out with you. There's a certain sort of like abrasive machismo on the page that comes out when you write. And just hanging out here, it's much more like you're kind of like a regular guy who wants to do good in the world. And he's like deeply philosophical and always exploring what it means to, like, you know, like give to and get from life. And you happen to have figured out a writing voice that really kind of allows you to build an audience and make a difference. And you kind of like step into that. Is that accurate or is that just like,
it's funny. All the time I meet readers and all the time they're like, wow, you're so much nicer in person than I thought you would be. And like, it gets really awkward because I'm like, is this a compliment? I don't know if this is a compliment. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's probably some sort of like unconscious thing going on there because I've heard things similar to that before. And it's interesting you say like the machismo thing. Like, all I know is that I write, like when I sit down to write, my only goal is to write something that I want to read, you know? And the voice that comes out for me, like once I write something that I've decided is good, like the voice that comes out is like, all right, that's awesome. Like, yeah. I want to read that, you know? So, but that makes sense. I'm a pretty like laid back dude. And I definitely, there's an intensity in a lot of my work, like this like kind of like aggressiveness.
Yeah. But I think it probably also speaks to, you know, there are, and it's probably not just you, it's probably all of us, right? You know, like we're not just one person with one.
Right.
We have light sides, we have shadow sides, and we each have different elements of ourselves that we bring to, that we show the world in different ways and different, you know, like channels and stuff like that. So it's kind of fun to sort of like see like these two things. And I've actually had enough conversations with writers too, where I know their work, where it's this fascination of mine now to kind of see.
Is it common?
Really common.
Yeah.
From what I've seen.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's been really interesting to kind of see over the years that, there are a couple of people that come to mind where, like, who write with this, you know, like, a voice which is, you would never guess that it's sort of like the same person just kind of hanging out.
That's funny. Like,
across the table. But so it's always really kind of fascinating to see that. Yeah, and I come out of, like, a marketing background where I know some of, like, the top copywriters, too. And they will literally, like, step into a persona.
Oh, wow.
In order to write this like deep, aggressive, you know, so like powerfully persuasive copy, they'll literally change clothes.
Yeah.
You know, and not shave for 3 days, and they'll have their hat that they put on, and they like drop into a persona and just write. And I sense that maybe not as deliberately, but a lot of writers do that to a lesser extent, to kind of like they step into that persona, which is like, okay, now like this is me as a writer, and now I'm kind of stepping back into this is just me kind of hanging out in life, because maybe it emboldens you to go somewhere that you might not do if don't feel like you're that person at that moment in time.
That's interesting. I can see that with myself when I sit down to write, because there is like, and it's not like I'm accessing a part of my personality definitely more so than the others, and I think, and that's where like a lot of that aggressiveness comes from. And I think a lot of that is just, I guess over the years I've been shown by people, my readers, that's effective, you know? And so it kind of like subconsciously encourages me to keep stepping into that part of my personality when I'm writing. That's interesting though.
Yeah.
I feel like I should like lay down on this couch and start telling you about my childhood. It's like
for you guys listening, we're like between studios. So we're hanging out in my living room right now on these really cushy couches. And like the fact that your eyes are still open right now because the air conditioning's off, it's getting a little bit warm. So let's take it full circle. So okay. Maybe this is a good life project. So if I offer that term out to you, a mm-hmm. guy who spends a lot of time thinking about these questions, what does it mean to live a good life?
What does it mean to live a good life? Living a good life means you have good problems. You have problems that invigorate you, excite you, and bring meaning into your life. That's what I would say.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. We love sharing real, unscripted conversations and ideas that matter. And if you enjoy that too, and if you enjoy what we're up to, I'd be so grateful if you would take just a few seconds and rate and review the podcast. It really helps us get the word out. And you can actually do that now, right from the podcast app on your phone. If you have an iPhone, you just click on the reviews tab and take a few seconds and jam over there. And if you haven't yet subscribed while you're there, then make sure you hit the subscribe button while you're at it. And then you'll be sure to never miss out on any of our incredible guests or conversations or riffs. And for those of you, our awesome community, who are on other platforms, any love that you might be able to offer sharing our message would just be so appreciated. Until next time, this is Jonathan Fields signing off for Good Life Project.